this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Hey, here's a really startling statistic about money. The fact is that 70% of families will lose all of their wealth within a couple of generations. Now, you may have heard this old saying, and they have a different version of it in many cultures, but here in America, it goes like this: shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. And what that means is, if you build your wealth, you might lose it, well, your family will lose it, by the time you have your grandchildren. So, you know, we talked about money a lot in our last show, and our guest, Garrett Gunderson, gave us the financial fundamentals to protect our wealth. But you see, it takes a whole lot more than tactics. Your family has to be on board. And for the last 25 years, my friend Joanne Stern has been consulting with hundreds of America's families, just like yours, to help them keep what they have worked so hard to earn. But more importantly, she's also learned a whole bunch of lessons that help families grow stronger at the same time. And these are the same secrets that you're going to be able to use to improve your family's mutual trust, respect, and communication to make sure that you guys stay together and also so that your wealth lasts for generations. Now, during Joanne's life's research, she's also come across incredible business lessons from parents that she's been interviewing. And so that will help you deepen your relationships at work and at home. And vice versa, she's learned a lot of parenting lessons that will help you grow your business. So it's really going to be great to go and share this with you. Now, I actually had my friend and ETR's editor, Jeff Steen, at the mic again in this episode to do a deep dive with Joanne and uncover some of those parenting and leadership lessons. Anybody who wants greater wealth or stronger relationships is going to get plenty of secrets to success from this episode of Early to Rise Radio. Before we get to it, though, I want to remind you that Early to Rise Radio is brought to you by my book, The Perfect Day Formula. So you can grab a free copy of this blueprint to success at freeperfectdaybook.com. It gives you the tools you need to level up in every area of life. Whether you're a parent, a leader, or just an ambitious go-getter, this is just going to be a real game changer for you. So again, this is Craig Valentine from Early to Rise Radio. Let's give the interview over now to ETR editor Jeff Steen and his guest, Joanne Stern.
Hey there, ETR listeners. We're joined today with Joanne Stern. Joanne, thanks for being on the podcast with us today. We don't often have the opportunity to talk to folks in the lifestyle realm. We do a lot of self-improvement stuff and even some finance interviews, but it's great to have you on board because a lot of our readers and listeners have been requesting more information about how to balance a home life with work, especially if they're entrepreneurs and work is all consuming. And you know what we're going to talk about today, some of the skills and experiences that you can leverage in both spaces so that you're not pulling yourself too thin, you're making the most of everything on both sides. But I want to get to some of your background before we get into the specifics of today's show, just so our listeners are aware. You have a double master's in counseling and theology, and I actually, it's funny, I saw the theology. I also have, it's a graduate certificate, but I studied theology myself.
Really? That's interesting. Yeah.
You don't hear that too often, actually, but it was very cool, and the two go hand in hand for sure. So you have those two things. You also have a PhD in human and organizational systems, and that is from, I want to say Harvard.
Fielding Graduate University.
Mm-hmm. Where is it from? I'm sorry?
Fielding Graduate University.
Okay.
In Santa Barbara.
Okay. You also currently run a private psychotherapy practice, is that correct?
No, I had a psychotherapy practice for about 25 years, but for the last 7 or 8 years, I've been doing consulting for families of high net worth, working with them on the family dynamic and family relationship issues that come up in every family and a unique kind of set of problems that happen with families with wealth.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a sort of an interesting angle to some of the counseling that you do. You've written for Bonner and Partners Family Office, I know.
Right.
Are you still working? Are you still writing for them?
No, we stopped maybe 8-ish months ago, but I wrote for them for 5 years.
Yeah, quite some time.
Yeah,
I know.
Right.
And there's this intersection in your work between wealth and family. And the preservation of wealth in families and across generations, that's really interesting. I don't think it's talked about that much. So
right.
Definitely a much needed niche, expertise in that niche. And then you have two books, which I will commend to our audience. They should go check them out. Both available on Amazon, I believe, and I think through your website as well. High Performance Families and then Parenting is a Contact Sport.
Right.
And it was just those two, right? Do you have
that's right. That's right.
Third one coming out anytime soon or no?
No, I don't think so. Not at the moment.
All right. Well, two is quite impressive just the same. So I encourage our listeners to go check those out. One of the things that I, from your own mouth, that I would love to hear, and it has some application for today's conversation, but just for clarification, what exactly is a family wealth preservation consultant? What do you do in that role?
Well, I'm glad you asked actually, because, there are undeniable, undisputed statistics and studies that show that 70% of families of wealth lose that wealth within 3 generations. So it's like the first generation makes it and the second generation spends it. By the time that wealth gets to your grandchildren, if you're the wealth creator, that wealth is pretty much gone. So you see families on the Fortune 500 list, and there are more of them than have ever been. But when you look closely, very few of them are families who were on it a couple of generations ago. I mean, they're gone because the money is wasted. So the question is, what is the root cause for this failure in a family's ability to transfer their wealth from generation to generation and become what we call a multi-generational family in the wealth space? And it's astounding to me. It's astonishing to me. You would think, well, they have to get better legal advice. They have to get better financial advice. No, wrong. Only of the families that fail, and we're talking at least 70% of them, and when these families have family businesses, it's 90% of those family businesses fail. And of those failures, only 3% of that failure is due to poor legal or financial planning. These people have platoons of people who are extraordinarily competent at what they do. So then it begs the question, well, then why are they failing? And again, the vast majority of failures have their root cause in lack of communication and distrust, lack of trust, poor communication skills and lack of trust. So in order, the basis for the work that I do in consulting with families of wealth is to help them work on their family dynamics and their family relationships, help them improve their communication skills, build their bonding and their family harmony, increase their trust and communication so that when they get together, they make more good decisions than bad decisions. And that's really the bottom line. If you make more good decisions than bad decisions, you will preserve and grow your wealth. If you have family discord and tension and stress and rebellion and family members who are in conflict with each other for a myriad of reasons, you won't be able to come together and have healthy discussions and conversations about important family members, and your wealth goes down the drain. So it's family wealth preservation. I'm helping families preserve their wealth by dealing with the people problems within their family, the problems, conflicts, jealousies, rivalries among siblings, their inability to make policies and procedures within their family businesses that are fair with all the family members that may want to come into the business, grandchildren, etc., and to make good decisions so that they preserve their wealth and are one of the 30% who are successful in being able to transfer their wealth beyond 3 generations rather than in the 70% who fail. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It reminds me of, I don't know if you're familiar, it reminds me of the farcical Arrested Development series. I don't know if you've ever seen that on TV, but That is sort of the quintessential example of the 70%. I mean, they take it to a ridiculous length, but it just, you know, it makes me laugh. I wonder, before we dive into the topic for the podcast, because this is very interesting, it could be a podcast on its own, actually. I'm wondering if the problems that you see that cause this dissipation of wealth over three generations, are those problems the same problems that other families have?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a very good question. Some of them are just regular, normal family issues. For example, one of the things that I deal with, this is just an example, is obviously your family grows and expands because people get married and they bring what I call immigrants into the family.
You know, yeah, right.
People that come in from the outside, and they have a different socioeconomic background. They have a different cultural background. They have a different perspective and view on life. Yeah. That happens in any and every family. And how many problems come up in a family because of the inability of families to incorporate and adjust to and accept an in-law, or vice versa, that the in-law is unable to kind of assimilate into the family in a healthy way. So it creates huge tensions. The difference now, being with a family of wealth, mm-hmm. is if you are a middle-class family or a blue-collar family or whatever, you're still going to have that problem, but you're not required to get together and make family decisions, because there is no family decision. There isn't a set of trusts or a set of investment decisions that need to be made, or, you know, decisions about whether to expand or grow your business or sell and liquidate your business or whatever. You just say, I don't like you, I'm not coming to Thanksgiving dinner. And so the family can split up, but it doesn't have an economic effect on the family. So in a way, it's a very common problem, but a wealthy family has to deal with it, because if they don't, it's going to affect the success of their business. A family without those financial ties can just say, eh, I don't like you, I'm going away. And you have family disharmony, but it doesn't spill over into the success of a business. And there dozens of those kinds of things. There's families that have addiction in their family.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Obviously that runs the gamut. Anybody and everyone can have an addiction in their family. But when you have a 35-year-old second generation who is poised to become the president of your family business that's worth $50 or $500 million, and this 35-year-old happens to be a drug addict and alcoholic, then it involves the family in ways that, you know, if there was no money in the family, you would deal with it differently. And it would have a different set of ramifications on the family. So it's all those kinds of things that, you know, in order to preserve your family wealth, you need to deal with issues. But many of them are, you know, just every family's problems. They take on sometimes a different twist when there's money involved. I always say the mix of love and money is really difficult. It's really difficult, the mix of love and money.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've definitely seen that play out, and so I see the need, very, very definitely the need for that kind of therapy and counseling, consulting, and like I said, this is obviously its own topic. You've spent 25 years sort of navigating that with families,
right.
But I want to shift a little bit, because we have a slightly different topic for the podcast today. Still ties into some of that, so there might be some overlap, but. Mm-hmm. 25 years ago, maybe longer, I don't know when you completed your PhD, you told me you were doing your dissertation, and you did a lot of research at the time about skills that were transferable from work to home and vice versa. So I want to talk a little bit. We have, you know, like I said, a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of business folks who are looking at making the most of those spaces.
And right.
The struggle is knowing where the boundaries lie, and if it's possible to have overlap and the exchange between the two. So I think this is very valuable to our listeners. So let's start with something you mentioned briefly before I started the podcast, in how those skills are transferred from one to the other, what that relationship looks like.
Yeah, okay. Well, I may just start by saying that when I was working on my dissertation 25 years ago or whatever for my PhD, the research that I found, there was a lot of work that went into what is the spillover or the transfer when leaders at work go home. And it was, and at that time, it was mostly about women, because obviously it was well accepted that men go to work and men go home, but it wasn't as accepted that women go to work and women go to home. And so all that research that was done on women at that time and in the 80s and 90s were, oh, it's negative. You know, women get stressed and then they go home and they're not very good moms, and they can split up their marriages. And, you know, it was a lot of negative research about the spillover from work to home. So the area that I wanted to focus on is, well, is there anything, what about the spillover from home to work? Is there anything that a mom at that time, and now you would say a mom or a dad, because there are certainly a lot more stay-at-home dads now, and certainly couples who are absolutely co-parenting in ways that people didn't do 20, 30 years ago. So is there a positive spillover from home to work? Do you learn anything at home parenting your children that could in any way be beneficial for you when you go to work? And it was astounding what I learned back then. And now, you know, I did that research for my dissertation, but I continue to do research some 5 and 10 years after that, because I was really going to write another book about this, and I didn't do it, but I did a lot of the research. And, you know, what I would have to say is, back in the 80s and the 90s, there were some business gurus who talked about what are the characteristics of a good leader. And what they found way back then, and those of your listeners who are familiar with Peters and Waterman book, The In Search of Excellence, it was such a classic, I guess still is. Peter Drucker, Warren Bennis out of USC, people like that, Peter Senge, big business gurus who were looking at what are the characteristics of good leaders. And what they discovered was, honestly, many of those characteristics are characteristics that parents, and in those days it was mostly moms, but I would say parents, the characteristics that they develop at home from being a parent. And and Sally Helgeson wrote a really, I thought, fabulous book called The Female Advantage, originally written in 1990, that talked about what women specifically bring to the workplace. It's a female, the female advantage, the specific characteristics of women when they come into the workplace as leaders. Why is that? Where do they learn those skills? And that was what I focused my research on with.
And that was not necessarily connected to female parents. It's just females as leaders in the workplace, which was less common then, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, except for that women were the parents. So it really ended up being moms learned something at home, parenting their children, that when they went to work, they went, wow, this is really an advantage to my leadership skills at work. And so it kind of came for me that, you know, the skills that moms and dads learn at home while parenting their children, you're not, sometimes you feel like your brain just maybe atrophied because you're dealing with a 2-year-old or a 7-year-old or whatever. It's not really stimulating. And yet I'm going to go into them. I'll go into 6 specific ones that really focusing on that actually prepares them for being an excellent leader at work. I mean, you can actually think of a parent as a CEO of a small business when you think about the family in that sense. Eleanor Roosevelt said once, a home requires all the tact and executive ability required in any business. I thought that was kind of profound that she would have said that so long ago. So I'm, you know, if you want, I will just sort of discuss each one. I have 6 of them actually that I focused on in my own work, and what I did was I interviewed probably 40 leaders in the work from one end of the country to the other and about this topic. What are the leadership skills that you think you have that have made you successful in your careers? Hmm. And where do you think you learned those skills? And
well, let's go. I'm sorry. Let's set the stage a little bit so that the listener knows exactly how this can apply to them specifically. So you've talked a lot about how you know you're interested in the female, the parent female takes those skills to the workplace and how they can be beneficial. To be clear, and obviously I haven't heard these points yet, but these are applicable to any parent, any individual. What is the category like? What are the demographics we're looking at where this application is readily applicable to the listener?
This is any parent.
Just any parent. Okay.
And so in the past, as I said, most of the parenting was done by women. Today, the parenting is done so much more by both parents. And so I think dads, absolutely as much as women, are learning these skills at home, and they too bring them to the workplace. And so I think it's a very interesting and helpful concept for parents to know that their time at home is not just wasted on toddlers, so to speak. It's really when they think about that when they're raising their kids, they're really learning valuable skills that can transfer to their careers and their work.
There's before you dive into the first one, it just reminds me of a story. I don't know if you saw the TED Talk by Sonda Rhimes, who's a TV producer.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was really impactful for me when talking about her daughter and the perspective that their relationship over time gave her on work. So you are familiar with it? You've seen that particular?
You know what? Mm-hmm. I know Sonda Rhimes. I haven't seen the TED Talk, but I just made a note of it because I want to watch it.
Oh, it's very good. Very, very good. Yeah, I highly recommend it. But anyway, it just sort of ties into the point that, yes, obviously there's a lot your kids can teach you and your life at home can teach you about work. So let's get into it. So what is the first of the six then that you would start with?
I would start with multitasking. It's the art of juggling and keeping multiple balls in the air and yet staying in control. And where that comes from is that parents, when they're raising their kids, don't really have the luxury of doing one thing at a time. Just an example is when I interviewed a real estate broker, we'll call her Lori, and she was starting her business. She had a baby on her hip. A toddler was tugging on her shirt sleeve. She was stirring something on the stove. Her husband was trying to get her attention for something he needed. And the whole time she's on the phone negotiating a real estate deal. And when she talked to me, she said, "You know what? I never thought about it before. There's no way I could have done that without my experiences of raising my kids. I could never have done that real estate deal because I learned those multitasking skills at home raising my kids." And there's a contrast there of a parent who comes home from work, they're tired and stressed, they go right to their office, close the door and say, "Don't bother me, I have to make a call." I mean, that's the old way where they have to be linear in their work. Well, workplaces don't give you the luxury of doing things linearly anymore. Things are flying at you from every direction in a workplace. As a leader, a multitude of things are coming at you at the same time for which you have to make space in your day to deal with. And this art of juggling, having all these balls in the air, multitasking, while you're still staying in control is a huge thing that you learn at home that can be very, very helpful in the workplace.
It's interesting you say that because there's a lot of evidence, science out there now in the ether, I guess, that talks about how multitasking, people pride themselves on it, and yet it's bad for you. The human mind does not multitask all that well. So I'm wondering how you would address that in this situation.
I mean, I like your question. And I think the science has been showing that you don't actually, that multitasking isn't really
a way of
describing it, because your brain literally is not capable of doing two things at once.
Right, you know? Right, yeah.
But the idea that you learn to flex and bend and move quickly from one thing to the other is something that multitasking sort of is, that's what I mean by multitasking.
Right.
I think in the past people thought that you really could keep two things in your head at the same time and do two things at once. They've discovered scientifically that your brain doesn't do that, but it's the art of being able to flip from one thing to the other rather quickly as the stimulus comes in or the need arises, and yet still kind of keeping your feet on the ground and being able to stay in control about it, which is really helpful because when you have a crisis at home, you've got to deal with it very quickly. And when you have a crisis at work, you also have to deal with it quickly. And you can't say, you know what, I'm working on this spreadsheet right now. I know this call came in from China and we have to make this decision in 5 minutes, but you know what? I'm really working on a spreadsheet, you know, come back to me in an hour or tomorrow. You have to be able to make that flip really quickly. And that's a skill that you learn at home.
Is there, I'm wondering, not to sort of belabor this particular point, because I see what you're saying and I agree, but I'm just wondering if there are any psychological studies, scientific studies that actually are able to show an ability for a parent who learns this skill of multitasking, in quotes, we'll call it, who take it to the office and then show that nimble character. But that nimble character is really evidenced in how quickly they can refocus on a different task going one to the next. Is there anything like that that you've seen, or is it just sort of generally that people talk about their success in doing that in the workplace?
Yeah, I think it is actually an issue of how quickly you're able to unfocus and refocus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's probably exactly what it is. Your ability, and I like the word nimble. It's your ability to unfocus on the thing that you're doing, disconnect from what you're doing, and reconnect with the more urgent thing, the more important thing that just came up.
I mean, it's very clearly got application in the workplace right now, and I don't think it necessarily takes away from the science behind multitasking and encouraging us to spend some time focusing on the important tasks. But yeah, agreed that it's that nimble nature is very helpful in the workplace. All right, so let's move on to number two. What's the next one on your list?
Flexibility. It's about going with the flow. And I mean, if I start, you know, this is the skills you learn at home that you take to the office, and then we'll go the other way when we're done. So the flexibility, going with the flow, and from the parent end, you know, there is no such thing as having a rigid set of rules because things change fast with your kids. I mean, you always have to have a plan B or a plan C or a plan D or a plan F. So it's developing a mindset for change, developing a mindset that I'm going to have to learn how to bend to adjust, because with kids, nothing ever goes as planned. I mean, it's sort of like you can't say to your kid, you know what, I've got a really important meeting today at 11 o'clock. This really isn't a very good day for you to be sick. Can you wait until tomorrow to throw up? I mean, you can't do that. And so for parents, the only constant for all of us, but particularly for parents, the only constant is change. And so they do learn to have plan B's and plan C's, to just flex and go with the flow and adjust into whatever the new reality is.
Yeah, tying in again to that multitasking nimble element as well, which is very helpful.
A little bit, and yet it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different than unfocusing and refocusing in that sense. I know people who, you know, they've made this plan, and when something happens to upset the plan, they go into a dither. They don't really have the ability to flex around that or kind of adjust to the new information that came in. It's not going from one thing and then to the other and then refocusing and back and forth. It's more, I'm willing to adjust. I have a mindset that says, okay, I'm going to go with this, you know, until I have to go with something else. And then I'm going to have to go to a different plan. I can't be rigid.
Right.
Because rigidity doesn't work at home, and rigidity doesn't work at work. And so it's this ability to just kind of go, okay, we're changing direction now. I get it. And we have to go to plan B. I can do that.
Is there when you talk about plan B, so contingency plans, you know, if something doesn't pan out, clearly there is value in that. Do you mean that in a more formal way, or do you mean that just sort of as a training of the mind to almost instinctively develop those contingencies for just about anything, so that you can more quickly process new information and then act with that new information without, you know, a strong reaction or a delay.
Yeah, the latter, yeah. Not the former. It's not, you know, having set up in a formal sense, plan A, plan B, plan C. It's just like you have this mindset that we're going to do this, but when it doesn't work, you say, we're going to have to change course here, and this seems to be the best route to go now. So it's not a, you know, like I've already set it up in advance, because you'd make yourself nuts if you had plan, you know, multiple plans for every single thing that happened in your life. There's no way to do that. There's no way to actually do that. That in itself would be a rigidity that would, you know, knock you flat. So it's just having that mindset of saying, I understand that life has its own course and that I don't always have control over how I'm going to wind my way through the maze of it. So I'm just going to adapt this mindset of adjusting and going with the flow.
Is there a danger in that that you have seen or that has been expressed to you by some of the folks you interviewed in being overly
wishy-washy?
Well, you might call it that. I was going to say overly flexible, but yeah, wishy-washy in the sense that they just get used to going with the flow and not saying, well, this is important to me, so I'm going to dig in on this.
I think you can overdo anything. Anything that's good, if you do it too much, it becomes not good. So obviously there's a boundary on one end that says, don't be wishy-washy. Don't cave in to every little barrier that comes up. Be willing to push to and through the barrier, obviously. But then rigidity is on the other end and say, nope, not going to change for this. This is the way we plan it. This is what we're going to do, even though it isn't even in touch with what's going on anymore. And so, yeah, you're in the middle of that always.
How did the people you interview find that boundary? Just experientially?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how to answer that question. The people that I have worked with and talked with and interviewed, they very much understand the concept of rigidity. And they realize that rigidity just doesn't work. It doesn't work. And I guess I would have to say that the people that I've talked with who are leaders, they are very motivated. They are leaders kind of by maybe definition, are motivated and hard workers, and they have a vision and they have goals and they have objectives and they have action steps to get there. And so I have found in the people that I've worked with that wishy-washy and not standing up for going the direction you wanted to go is sort of a little bit inbred. They definitely know where they want to get to. They definitely have the goal in mind. It's just that there's more than one way to get to the goal. That may be.
It's
not giving up your goal. It's not bending to the vision or the objective. It's not caving into that. It's being willing to say, there's another way to get there. Or there's another time frame in which to get there. And there are resources I have available to me to help me get there if I can't get there on my own. I mean, it's more ability to adjust.
That makes sense. That's a good way to put it, actually, because I think the perspective is huge for people in that position, well, in any position, but specifically as a leader, when there are things that need to be accomplished. Okay, so let's move on to
the third one.
Third one, yeah, we're on number three, okay.
Well, I would say prioritizing. You know, in today's world, I mean, do you have a to-do list? Do I have a to-do list? And I keep crossing them off, and I never seem to get to the end of them.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, particularly, I mean, I'm coming still from the perspective of home, what you learn at home. You just can't get everything done. You can't get everything done. I mean, even if you get down pretty much to the laundry and get the beds made and get dinner on the table, then you still have the silver to polish or, you know, I don't know, the weeds to pull. I mean, you just never get to the end of your list. It's just always too much to do. It's the world we live in, and you're always getting interrupted. So I would say that you learn to triage. And, you know, with kids at home, you learn to triage. One kid wants one thing, but the other one just fell down and, you know, bumped their knee. And so you have to take care of the most important things first. Mm-hmm. And then work your way down the list. So honestly, if you had 40 things on your list to do today and you got down to 28 left over, that's a good day, because you understand, you know, super human it's sort of out of vogue. I mean, years ago, it was, you know, all about being a super parent, a super mom, a super dad, whatever. That's long since gone, because there's a realization that you just can't do it all. Right. And part of it is probably giving up the ability to give up your kind of perfectionism in a way of getting it all done. There's just, you know, the new perfect is imperfect. Anybody who strives for perfect is already not perfect, because that doesn't work anymore. So it's the ability to put the most important things on the top of the list and work your way down to triage. I think a lot of times in today's world, at home and at work, we cave into the urgent. There's the old saying, you know, it's nothing new to anyone. We cave into the urgent, and then we neglect what's really important. We run after, it's sort of like your emergency is not my emergency kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so we have to learn to kind of call out what's really important and what is just somebody else's emergency, or it kind of glares in front of you like an emergency, but it really isn't the most important thing to do. So we learn to prioritize, and it's a skill that parents learn at home in raising their kids, and it's hugely transferable to the office.
Do you, in your experience, have you seen that as a serious pain point for a lot of business types who don't have experience at home with parenting?
I would have to say that in my own personal research, I have only, because of the slant of my own research, mm-hmm. I talked only with people who were parents and then who were also leaders in their workplace. And I talked with them about what they felt they learned at home that helped them. And that's really where I'm getting these six.
Sure.
These six things are from my own interviews of about 40 successful leaders in career, but they also were moms. And in our conversations, it was sort of like, what do you think makes you good at your work? And I said, where do you think you learned that? And that's what they said to me. Oh, you know what? I learned that at home. Hmm. So people who were not parents, being a parent, I would have to say that it absolutely changes you, and that people who are not parents have a different perspective or view on life and a different way of doing things. I think people that I know that are my age who haven't been parents have, I don't mean to stereotype it, but often have not the same sensibilities or sensitivities to the complexities of life, or the compassion for other people's struggles and hurdles, because they're just going through life with their own stuff. They haven't had to kind of bend to the needs of a little person that they love more than their own life. And it makes a difference in who you are and how you approach your world.
Yeah, I was going to say that you put that very well. I was just going to say, in the realm of priority, they may be able to create a list fairly effectively of to-dos for the day, but the idea of the responsibility and the relative importance of those responsibilities in the life of a parent is very different than you probably find at work, because you're dealing with human life.
And so yes.
That understanding of the relationship of the importance of those responsibilities greatly informs what you do in the office. It gives you a lot more perspective on what's really important and what isn't. And that translates to being able to prioritize things and then just, you know, look at things that are far less important in that grand scheme. and put that at the bottom of the list. Whereas, you know, someone who hasn't had that experience might freak out about minor things. So yeah, the point is taken. And being not a parent, some of this is eye-opening to me as I think about it now. and will be, you know, at some point in the future, hopefully when I become a parent. So, all right, let's move on to number four.
Okay, number four is decision-making. And I have two concepts with decision-making. And the first one is that making a decision within the appropriate context. And what I have found is that parents, when they make a decision, they tend to talk with their kids. They look them in the eye. They look for their preferences, their needs, their wants. They have family meetings, and they get their kids' input before they make the decision, so that the decision takes into account the whole picture, the whole context of the family. They don't just make a decision in a vacuum that follows a set of rigid rules, or this is the way we do it, or I'm making this decision because I'm the boss. You know, you use your gut, you use your tuition, but your decision is more likely to take other people into consideration when you make it. And this is actually a big point for in these interviews that I did with women, is that they said, you know, when I make decisions at the office, I try to check into what works for the other person, for my employee. I look at their schedules. I look at what particular situation they're in, and then I try to make a decision that fits for them, that works for them. And that's what parents do. They'll take into account, you know, their kids' schedules, their problems, their needs. You know, you got some work to do around the house. They say, well, one child prefers cleaning out the garage. The other one prefers helping inside the house. So instead of making a rigid demand that says, okay, no matter what, you're working the yard today. I mean, they might do something like, before we decide how we're going to do this, would you like to work in the yard today, child A, because you prefer being outside, and child B, would you like rather help inside the house? I mean, they're just taking the situation, the context into account before they make a decision. And then it just works better. It creates a sense of team and appreciation of the individual people, and people go with that decision. They accept the decision better because they know that their needs and wants were taken into account. Sometimes it doesn't always work, but they know that the parent or the employer tried. They tried to take their own situation into account. It creates a happier, more productive workplace. It creates a better family environment. And the other one is trying to create consensus. And at home, it's sort of, would you guys rather have pizza for dinner or pasta? Would you rather go to Hawaii or Mexico for vacation? You know, would you rather work in the yard or wash the windows? I mean, there's sort of, let's get a consensus of what you all want to do. Whether you're 3 years old or 15 years old, you still have your preferences. And I'd like, as a parent, to try to create this sense of team and cooperation by creating a consensus of what we want to do and how we want to do this, because we're a family, we're a team. We're in this thing together. And so good enough parents, because there's no perfect parents, all you have to do is be good enough, want to try to get a consensus among the family as much as they can, because when you do it, you get better participation, more cooperation, more of a sense of team and pride, and you accomplish your goals better. And it's the same at work.
I will say, I agree with you. If, you know, in any leadership situation in the workplace that I have been in, it's much more rewarding for everyone involved to have buy-in to a decision, not only because, you know, everyone understands that their needs and desires were taken into consideration, but then they feel some kind of investment in that decision and the forward movement of the company or the
product. Totally, totally. And I, at workshops in the past or presentations that I've done, you know, I've even said to people, write down, think back and think of the best boss you ever had and the worst boss you ever had, and what made this one the best and what made this one the worst. And a lot of times, this is what comes up. You know, they didn't take me into account. I mean, they treated me like, you know, a number. They didn't even know, you know, I wasn't taken into account.
Well, and even when you have a situation where a boss or a parent has to stick to the rules, and usually it's for the sake of the company as a whole.
Sure.
They know more information about what's happening or what's needed or bigger priorities than the individual employees or the kids do. And there's a bigger value there that they have to pay attention to. I think a good parent, just as a good leader in the workplace, won't just say, no, I'm not going to do what you want to do. They will say, well, I have to stick to rule X, and this is why. Let me explain to you why it's important that I say no to you and go this other route instead.
Exactly.
There's
a sense that I care about you. And when the other person knows that I care about you, whether it's my child or my employee, there's more respect and more honoring of the decision that's made.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Yeah. More trust developed there.
More trust developing.
Closeness. Yeah. Okay. So five,
Number five is empowering. So one of the most important things that a parent can do with a child is to encourage. I mean, I would say even gently push the child into making their own decisions. I mean, gradually in age appropriate ways, giving them more responsibility so that they learn to make better decisions. You don't just turn 21 and suddenly you're an adult and now suddenly you can make great decisions. You have to learn that gradually over time. And it's a little bit the opposite of a helicopter parent who's just like hovering over them so that they don't do anything wrong. And right. And the empowering parent will gently, gradually push their child into encouraging them to make their own decisions, because what's the result of that? They become more self-reliant. They become more confident. It gives them more self-esteem.
Yes.
Increases their sense of independence. And the other thing that happens is sometimes the parent will say, well, go make a decision, but then they don't actually let go of the rope. So they don't actually give them the authority. They tell them to do it, but they don't give them the authority to actually do it on their own. And that's obviously a big thing at work, too. So it's not only encouraging them to make their own decision, but to give them the resources and the authority to actually do it in age-appropriate ways.
Sure,
because it shows that you trust them. So when you give your kids ample opportunity to flourish and grow, and you actually encourage them to follow their strengths, which requires that you really spend time with your children and know them deeply personally to know what their strengths are, then you can encourage them to go toward their strengths rather than trying to push them into something you'd like them to be, but it really isn't who they are at all. So a lot of that on the parenting home end is encouraging them to do beyond what they think that they can do. That's the opposite of the helicopter parent. In fact, a book for your audience, and one of the best books I've ever read, is How to Raise an Adult. It's by Julie, and it's a hyphenated last name, Lythcott Haymes, Lythcott-Haymes, Haims. It's fabulous. It's how we're really doing damage to our children by hovering over them for fear they'll hurt themselves or make a mistake or not do their best, and it's really damaging them to flourish in the 21st century, because in order to flourish in the 21st century, kids have to learn to think outside the box, because anything inside the box is soon going to be relegated to technology because a computer can do it. So in order to teach your kids how to think outside the box and be really creative, you have to empower them doing these things. I say, encourage them to go beyond what they may even think that they can do. And part of the parenting progress process is celebrating their own progress, but not focusing on their accomplishment, focusing on their process, because this is how they learn and grow. Another great book by Carol Dweck, D-W-E-C-K. It's called Mindset. And she talks about a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. And a fixed mindset is one that says, I'm going to the goal, and unless I reach the goal, I'm a failure. And the growth mindset is one that, you know, it's the process of learning and growing and making mistakes and being challenged and even going on and on. That's the person who's going to succeed in the 21st century, not the one that, you know, is very fixed and rigid. It's about helping your children develop grit. I mean, another set of research around this is by Angela Duckworth at the University of Pennsylvania. I mean, the work of teaching your kids grit, which is sort of a version of developing resilience and determination and pulling yourself up by the bootstraps and not being thwarted by failures and mistakes, but just keep on keeping on, you know? So part of that empowering process is, you know, understanding and celebrating the mistakes and failures of your kids, because that's the way they learn and grow. And that's how you empower them. And I know one of the women I think of that I interviewed in the workplace was, she was a master at empowering her employees. I mean, she really delegated, and she gave them the authority to do things, knowing that, you know, maybe they would or wouldn't do it the way she would have done it, or maybe, you know, it wouldn't turn out exactly the way she wanted it, but she gave them the resources and the time to actually do it their way. Some bosses will say, yeah, go do it, but then they don't give you, they tie your hands behind your back so that, right, you know, right, you really can't get it done, because, I don't know, maybe the boss is afraid that the employee will show him up in some way, or he wants to be the who's the big kahuna. So the empowering boss is the one that allows the employees to shine. And this one particular woman said, you know, I really hire the person, not somebody to fill a job. I hire the person. And if that person doesn't have this, you know, perfect skills for the job that I thought, I will find another position for that person because I admire and respect the person. So she's really encouraging their strengths. And she has a phenomenally loyal and hardworking set of employees. A lot of it is because of that. And I said, well, what made you think of all of that? And she goes, you know, that's what I did with my son, teaching him when he was growing up. That is absolutely where I learned that that's what I wanted to do as a leader in my work, as the head of my organization. So empowering is a big one.
Right. Yeah. And I just want to, you know, I throw out there two things that came to mind for me is, you know, one, again, you know, if you do empower an employee as a child to make a decision, truly make a decision on their own, you're giving that investment again in the outcome, good or bad, and good, you know, they feel very good about themselves. If they fail, you're giving them the opportunity to deal with failure again, something that they will be, that will be invaluable to them as they get older. And then I think the third piece that ties into all of this is that it gives them the opportunity to learn how to ask for help when they need it, because that's key to being part of a larger ecosystem in business or at home, is knowing your weaknesses and shortcomings and knowing that your team aiming for a larger goal and that you do have to lean on some other people sometimes. So, I mean, that is huge for me personally as well, as, you know, I've seen that play out very positively in professional scenarios, business scenarios across all different.
I think that's a hugely important point. And I'm so glad that you said it. I didn't think of it, quite frankly. And I'm really glad that you said it, because in work today, in my own career, so I'm consulting with a family. Think of how complex a family is. I mean, I've worked with families who are selling a billion-dollar family company. I'm interacting with attorneys and boards of that company. And you know, my field is not legal or financial. I need help with some of that.
Right, yeah,
and for absolutely. Me to be able to say to that family, this is not my area of expertise, let me contact one of my colleagues and bring them in or get some advice from them, because this is a really important thing for y'all and you deserve the very best that you can get. We need to learn to help. The world is way too complex and too big for anyone to think that they can do it all, you know?
Right. And that expectation if it's out there, it's unreasonable. And I don't think it's a healthy one. And so we should definitely move it.
I love that you brought that up. I made a note for myself.
So thanks. all right. So number six on this list, and then we'll sort of flip the script and go from work to home.
Okay, great. Well, the last one is maybe the most important one of all. And it's just, and we've probably covered it in a lot of ways, people skills. Successful career women from one end of the country that to the other that I talked with said that this is their first and foremost skill that has led to their success. And what I mean by people skills is just showing compassion, caring, empathy, being encouraging, being understanding, being kind. It's more of having a human connection to the people at your work. And think about, you know, that's the quintessential thing of a mom or a dad is all of those characteristics.
Right.
So a big part, it's that these people, I mean, I always say with the families that the families that I work with is, you know, it's very myopic to think of your wealth as being your financial capital, how many zeros there are in your portfolio, because truthfully, your greatest wealth is your human capital. It's the people in your family and how you treat them and how you encourage and support them. And that's, so I think that's a huge thing that parents do at home. And I have to say that a big part of people skills is listening. We are not very good listeners.
Oh, that's so true.
We really rather hear our own selves talk than listen.
Yeah.
And when I say listening, I mean really hearing what the other person is saying. We call it active listening in the psychotherapy world. I mean, it means, you know, you have to put down everything that you're doing. It is hard work to really active listen. It means that you're listening for what's going on between the words. You're listening for feelings. You're reading body language. You're looking at their eyes, their facial expressions, their tone of voice. For your child, you're trying to get inside the skin of your child. You're putting yourself in your child's shoes. So when he talks, you're not reading the newspaper or writing a text or scrolling through your emails. You put down what you're doing and you look at him. Mm-hmm. And you make sure that you understand what he's saying by either reflecting what they say or restating what they say. And a lot of times, you know, your kids are saying stuff that's like, oh, really? I am so busy. I have so much on my mind. This is so not interesting to me. This has no relevance to me at all. You show interest even when the topic is not of particular interest to you because your interest is in your child. And when you listen in that way, it shows that your child is important to you. And that way he can trust you to have his best interests in hand. And so that listening is a huge part. And part of the people skills, quite frankly, is not prejudging or criticizing. You can have critique of the behavior, but you can't have critique of the child himself. That is his human soul and spirit. And so that is a huge part of being what I call a good enough parent. You know, a parent that really is going to gain the respect of your child. And really, you know, in parenting, that's all you have is a relationship with your child. That's my mantra for parenting is, don't do anything that disrupts the relationship of your child. I mean, you can discipline them, you can have tough love, but you always have to be respectful of that human spirit. And there's plenty of ability to critique a behavior and influence your child and guide that child, but you don't put them down and demean them, prejudge them and criticize them. And how well does that go over at work? It's the same concept. It's the same concept. So, people skills are a huge one.
I think it's interesting, the listening piece. That's something that we've talked about a lot at Early to Rise recently, and then tying into that, the digital distractions. Craig has something called digital detox that he's been promoting for quite some time, especially in this digital time. It's important to unplug, as it were, and set aside time. The listening piece is interesting to me, though, because well taken, and the point is completely valid for a lot of people, both at home and in the office. But I think it's interesting too that a lot of people, a lot of leaders, don't know how to say in an empathetic, respectful, and polite way when it's not the appropriate time to be listening. Hey, so and so, you know, I know you have something valid to say, but now is not the right time to be sharing it with me. I want to take time to really listen to it later. Let's make the time to do that. That isn't right now. That's, listening in and of itself in an appropriate time is also a challenge. I think that a lot of leaders and parents probably as well struggle with that moment and how to communicate that respectful yes, I want to hear you. I can't do it right now.
Well, that's a good point. And I think one of the ways that is absolutely true at home, and it's absolutely true at work. I mean, literally, just because your child comes in and wants to talk to you about something doesn't mean that you have to drop something really important that you're doing and listen. I mean,
right.
You can when you can, but sometimes you can't. But and it's the same at work. So one of the ways to get around the problem that you're posing is to say, let's set a time when I can really focus on what you're saying. I mean, unless it's an emergency.
Sure.
I don't have time right now, but I really care about this and I really want to hear it. What about this evening after dinner at 7 o'clock, right before you go to, or what about tomorrow or whenever? Set a time and a date. And then it's in there.
Commit to it.
You know, I have this deadline. I got to get it out by 1 o'clock. But after that, I would be free this afternoon and I would love, I really want to continue this and hear you.
Right. And making that commitment, putting something on the calendar is.
Putting something specific on the calendar, a date and a time. Yeah.
Yeah. Very important to that whole process. Absolutely. Okay. So let's flip the script and talk about, you know, what you learn in the office that has tremendous application as a parent at home.
And I think that sometimes you will find that these are maybe very similar things, only stated in a more business vernacular than parent vernacular. So the first one is, and I think I have five of them. The first one is an open door policy. The president, the manager, the team leader is now much more available and much more accessible than in days past, with a very inviting, an attitude of inviting people to come in and talk. Doors used to be closed. Walls were wood. Now walls are glass and doors are open. Obviously in most workplaces, there are open cubicles where employees have more availability and access to either. It's just access to each other. There's just a whole culture that promotes sharing. And it's just we talk with each other. We have an open door policy. In addition to that, the employees, the employers know employees by name. Often they work at doing that. They want to learn something about their lives. They want to take an interest in them. They don't try to act superior. They try to put themselves on a more egalitarian level. I talked with a woman who was the VP of a huge international company, and there was a point in her career where her position put her in charge of all these, a huge factory. And you know what she did? She put her desk on the factory floor, smack in the middle of her employees, wore the same clothes they did, which were kind of factory clothes, rather than dressed like an executive, because her idea was, I'm here for you guys. I want to know what's going on. I want to participate in what's going on. I want to be involved in what's going on. I'm not in an ivory tower. I'm right here with you. So it's the whole concept of flattening the organization, breaking down that top-down environment, and creating a culture of each person being important to the goals of the company. So there's more two-way conversations, and it's not just the command and obey model. It's more democratic, more egalitarian approach to decision-making. And that's really the way healthy families are operating. And do not hear me saying that in doing this, the parent is now becoming permissive and, you know, giving kids an equal vote in everything they do. There's just more of an attitude of an open door policy where it's not, I'm the boss, I'm the parent, as long as your feet are under my table, we'll do it this way. There's more of a flattening of that in a two-way conversation. At home, it creates an enormous amount of respect of the child for the parent. And when there is respect, it just makes discipline easier because they want to please you. It's not that they have to, they want to, because they really like what they like, that interaction. They love it. They love the interact. They like feeling important. And that's something that I think the organization, the business world lends to and confirms for the family.
For families at home. Yeah, I will say too that in circumstances where I have experienced that, it's actually a morale booster, because you're not constantly worried about what someone above you is seeing and judging and critiquing, or is, you know, throwing into your file as a possible black mark against you when it comes time for a job review. It's more of that collaborative environment. And so
and there's a sense of transparency. It's the open system, which is very much a healthy family system, and it's very much a healthy business environment, that transparency. So there's no secrets. Things aren't being hidden. Information is not being hoarded. It's being shared. And that all makes for a more productive, happier, healthier, more loyal work team.
And how many fresh and innovative ideas can then come to the fore because there isn't that metaphorical and literal door separating, you know, the workforce from its leader, from the CEO, or the child from the parent, and people who recognize their own strengths but are in the wrong place then have the opportunity to be put where, you know, they're happier and their skill set is better put to use. So,
well, yeah. Exactly. Like, right. What, I mean, the idea that only the good ideas come from the top echelons in the business, but you know, a lowly employee wouldn't possibly have a good idea. The same way at home, kids have fabulous ideas. They have, you know, they're not restricted by, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 years of a, you know, a culture that's continually boxing you in. I mean, they're really creative. So how cool to hear all those creative ideas.
Yeah. I also think, just one final point on this one, I also think that in an era where we're seeing a lot of tumultuous activity in a lot of larger corporations and higher management making ruthless decisions about layoffs, because of, you know, poor decisions by the management themselves, that has turned companies upside down. If you're there on the front lines with your employees, you're a lot more reluctant, rather, to start a bunch of layoffs, and a lot more likely to take the credit for things going upside down when you're in the mix with all of them. So, yeah, again, another big benefit there, more empathetic leadership. So let's dig into number two.
Well, new communication styles. I mean, the old in business, the old top-down command and obey, gone.
Yes,
nobody likes to be ordered around. Nobody likes to be ordered around. Nobody likes to be ordered around. Not at home, not at work. And if you do, you know what happens? At work, it creates a lack of cooperation, a lack of participation, a lack of motivation. It creates
rebellion sometimes.
It can even create rebellion. I mean, sometimes it creates an attitude of trying to find something wrong with the boss, sort of like catching him doing something wrong out of your for feeling put down.
Sure.
And, and at home, you know, when there's this new communication style that we're all in this together, there's also less rebellion, because you know what? There's nothing to rebel against. My parents are on my side. We talk about stuff. You know, I don't have anything to rebel against. I'm not saying that no teenager is ever going to not rebel, because, you know, rebellion comes in a lot of forms. But I mean, part of it is a very healthy developmental phase of individuating and differentiating and separating and creating your own self. But there's less of that kind of negative, violent rebellion when you have this two-way communication, that there's mutual sharing and we're in this together. It's again, this in this together. I mean, you just end up with a lot more cooperation within the family. And honestly, when I say there's less rebellion because there's less to rebel against, I really mean that. Somebody who comes down from the top of you at work or at home, it demeans you, it degrades you. And your human spirit feels that, and you have kind of a healthy sense of wanting to get out from under it, and you don't know what to do about it except rebel or step back and away from it. And that is not a healthy work environment. You don't get a lot of production out of that.
No, that's very, very true. And I'm seeing that actually play out in a lot of different realms. I used to be a food writer and was trained in the very classical French style in culinary school back in the day. And of course,
that's cool.
Really militaristic. You know, yeah, it was yeah. the executive chef, and, you know, it was this sort of command structure that existed in the kitchen. After I graduated, I would go into kitchens and interview chefs, and new restaurants would be popping up. And I would ask them, like, you know, because these titles started to go out the window, and I didn't know what to call people. So I was like, yeah. How is your team structured anymore? What happened to this hierarchy that used to be the backbone of the kitchen in all these restaurants? Yeah. Like, nobody does that anymore. I mean, people were leaving left and right because that kind of abuse, just people don't want it and they don't need it. They can go on and do their own thing, you know, and they don't have to put up with it. So same applies in business and at home. Yeah, it's very true that that is being, it's changing rapidly, and then you're getting
yeah.
a celebration.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Interesting that you've had that experience. It's really, my husband always says, "Gal, in not that he's not a culinary expert, loves me, but not so much in cooking, but you know, he says, "Gal, you know, you'd go to culinary school and you'd be sitting there making a sauce for 2 years before they'd cutting the vegetables before they'd even let you make the sauce. And now, you know, like you're making a sauce tomorrow because that's what you're here to do."
Right,
and we don't
right.
have to make it such an unattainable, I'm the expert and you're not kind of a
right.
situation. Yeah.
Right. It's more getting people to steer themselves toward their strengths and making
yeah,
space for them to do
yeah.
that. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's dig into number three.
Number three is participation. I mean, I think there's more of a sense in businesses of encouraging people to participate. So that they're creating a sense of team and teamwork. And you mentioned it before when we were talking on the family side, giving employees a sense of ownership. I mean, that is so important. Participation creates ownership. And when you feel that you own it, you have a whole different perspective on how you want to work towards a goal. So, you know, the participation is giving participants the opportunity to have input in decision making. And then there's team meetings where everyone discusses this together and you come, it's a participatory decision. And, you know, the studies show that employees who know the overall goals and objectives of the project and can see the end, whether that project is a product or a service, they work harder and faster than those people who know just their little piece of what's going on. It's like they're stuck in their own little wheelhouse, only communicating laterally with the people right around them. They're
yeah.
not sharing information with somebody, you know, before them or after them or above them or below them. They don't feel as much pride in their work and they don't do as good of a job. And I think of that old story of the bricklayer. You know, he asked somebody, three bricklayers, what are you doing? I'm laying bricks. And the second was, I'm building a wall. And the third one is, I'm creating a cathedral. And so which one is working harder and is more loyal to the whole cause? It's the one who sees the overall vision and the end product and has brought in and made to feel like I'm participating in something bigger than myself. And I want to be a part of this. So makes sense that they would work faster and harder and better. And so this idea of participation at work is really increasing the bottom line of a company. And it increases the emotional, more abstract bottom line in a family. You get more teamwork. You get more cooperation. You get more of a sense of family pride in being able to participate.
Yeah, but we're in this together. It's interesting, too, because I think what I have seen play out in the workforce when that's done successfully, and I have only seen it done on a sort of a small scale in smaller businesses, but it could apply just as readily to smaller teams within a larger corporation, is that you have your project lead, your CEO, whoever it happens to be. When that kind of participation, and ownership exists within the team, and people are allowed to sort of talk about where they're at with their projects and how it all fits together, the leader can disappear. They don't
yeah.
need
yeah.
to be there to oversee it because the team just sort of naturally has this momentum that moves them along, and then they, you know, the leader can focus on other more important things or the next project.
Yep. They manage themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they want to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They don't need incentive. So, yeah, very well taken. So what's number four?
Defining the corporate culture. It's like, what kind of a business do we have here? And, you know, every business has a culture. It's not like you get to choose if you want to have one or not. You have a culture. Yeah. Just like, and every family has a culture. It's the environment in which you do your business. It's the feeling that you have when you're in that space. So the question is, does it promote the well-being among the employees or not? Is it positive? Is this culture that we have positive for employees, or is it negative? Do people like to work here? Why or why not? What do we need to change to make our workplace more positive for everyone who works here and more productive? You're still in a business. You're trying to be productive. Right. But you can create a corporate culture that promotes well-being for your employees and also a great product for your customers or clients. And it includes things like, how do we treat people in this company? How do we treat each other? How do we acknowledge people in this company? How do we celebrate them? And how do we celebrate the accomplishments, not only of the individual people, but the accomplishments and the goals of our company? And how do we interact with customers and clients? Certain companies are known for their service and how well they treat their employees. And mm-hmm. other companies, it's like, well, customers, employer, they're just, you know, numbers and they represent money in our pocket. Other corporate cultures say, no, we want to be known for how well we treat our customers. And you know, I think of something like Nordstrom's, for example, who, you know, started out as a shoe company, and you can return a pair of shoes and a year later and they don't ask any questions because they have this corporate culture that we are here to be of service to our customers and within the company. You know, certain companies have a culture where, you know, we value the human capital within our company, how we treat people. And this is something that gives employees a sense of, again, belonging to something greater than themselves, something they can be yes. proud of, something that they've had a part in creating, something that they care about. And that's the same thing in a family. A family has a corporate culture as well. I know a family who, you know, around from time to time around their dinner table, they would say, you know, we are the Smiths and we're kind to people, K-I-N-D, we're kind to people. And that was just something that they wanted to immerse their children in that concept as they were growing up, is that that's how we behave. That is our ethic within this family. We are kind. And so we don't go to school and bully kids, or, you know, you're at a party and there's, you know, you leave one child out because they're weird or whatever. You know, right, we are kind to people in this family. And you can have myriads of those kinds of things. But it is creating a corporate culture and then creating a family culture that is really positive for the people within it and that really promotes them becoming the best people they can be. And that's something that I think is most known in the workplace for creating and defining your corporate culture, but it's something that's spilling over into families as well, as families realize that that's a very important thing to do. I mean, I do a lot of work with the families I consult with in helping them define their family culture and then identifying the components of that culture, because they may have been not aware. They wouldn't have been able to they never thought about their family's right. culture. So helping them to kind of illuminate and pull out the different components of their family culture and seeing which ones of them, like, oh my gosh, this is really healthy. We want to change this one. And, oh, this is great. We want to really spend more time developing this one.
Yeah, it's interesting you said that on Two for the Well. One, Craig has recently written about this, and there's a piece going on earlytorise.com here shortly about specifically about spending ample time creating company mission and vision, and then core values that support it, and making clear to all the employees that this is what we're about. And it's just as much about how we interact internally as it is how we interact with customers and prospects on the outside.
And that brings me to my number five, which is
I was just going to say, before you get there, sorry, I was just going to say that it made me think that, you know, in a corporate culture, it's pretty common when that exists to have that framed and put on the wall.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And to have that same kind of thing in the home, which sounds cheesy, but could actually be a tremendous benefit, especially to a young family that's still growing and maturing and figuring life out, to have those core values. And then, as you say, in the context of a dinner table conversation or gathered together, whatever that gathering is, to reiterate those core values and that mission and vision too. It's interesting, that correlation. But what were you going to say? What was the fifth one that ties into that?
Well, it's totally tied into it. It's like creating a business plan. And I actually have a whole presentation that I've done multiple times in creating a family business plan, because people go, what? But, you know, when you think about it, somebody who wants to start a business wouldn't even dream of starting it unless they knew what they were trying to achieve. What do we want to create or provide, or what action steps are we going to take to get there? And right. So they spend a lot of time thinking about and creating their vision statement and their mission statement and where are we going and how do we plan to get there? And they spend a lot of time writing this business plan before they even think about getting started with their business. They have to know how much money they're going to need to start and to keep going. They have to know how many employees they're going to need. They have to do future planning before they even start. What are their long-term goals? What, when, how are they going to deliver their products or services? And then they develop goals and objectives and constantly update them to make sure they're on track for achieving the success that they're anticipating. And part of that, then, a big part of that is needing to discuss and define their business values so they know how they will operate and what kinds of deals they're willing to make within the company and with their customers. I mean, just creating a business plan, that makes sense for every person who's ever been involved in a business at that level. But it also makes sense with a family. And I think you said it's kind of a cheesy idea. And I go, I've done multiple workshops and presentations with families and small groups on how to create a family business plan. And you don't have to be wealthy to do it. It has nothing to do with how much money you have. It has to do with this idea that Stephen Covey wrote about in his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Successful Families. Oh, yeah. I mean, first one was The Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. Then he wrote one, Successful Families. And he talks about beginning with the end in mind. And what he says, these are his ideas, not mine, but you wouldn't dream of starting to build a house without a set of architectural plans so that you know, where do you want the view plane and how many bedrooms do you want? And, you know, how big is the kitchen going to be? It's, I mean, you don't just start building a house. You have a set of plans so that you know where you're trying to end up. And similarly, you wouldn't take off in a plane without filing a flight plan. I mean, you can't just get up in the air and start flying. You have to know where you're going or you could end up in a lot of trouble. And so in a business, you wouldn't dream of beginning a business without having a plan of what you're trying to do or where you're trying to go. So honestly, I have to say, how much more important is your family than your business? And so I've worked with a lot of families on creating and developing their family business plan, because families also need to begin with the end in mind, because otherwise, how do they know how they want to raise their children, what values they're going to live by? Because your values are actually your moral compass. It's the moral compass of your family which dictates your decisions. So to begin a family without creating some sort of a plan for that and developing your mission statement and delineating your values and then talking about those values with your children so they grow up with those values kind of embedded within them, is hugely important and allows you the opportunity, much greater opportunity, to have what I would call a successful family, or the title of my book, a high performance family. Right. Whether there's money involved or not, you still want to have a high performance family. And creating this business plan helps you to get there. But it started, obviously, in businesses. and it has spilled over into family life.
Well, and just like with a business, it's important to know, based on your vision and mission, what the end is going to be.
Yeah, for sure.
But that you don't map out too many details. You have to leave room for life happening. You have to have contingencies for the big things that are important to you. So that, you know what what your goal for your kids is, ultimately, where you want your kids to go to school, or the amount of money you want to be able to give them when you pass on, or when you retire, or how much you want to subsidize for their college education, whatever it happens to be, knowing that life happens and that you have to be able to deal with that too. So, it goes back to that idea of flexibility and rigidity, and just having a plan in place for a guiding light, but knowing that there can be many paths to get there. So,
and that plan will change. So as your kids grow and their needs, and you have no way of predicting what are going to be the needs of your kids. But what's so valuable is, if you have those basic values underneath, that's where you always go back to. Yes. And there are a lot of ways to, for example, if you have a value of, wanting to have if you have a value that, like, we love horseback riding, this is a value, we get together and go horseback riding. Well, that's not really a value. That the value underneath that is that we love being together.
Right.
Family harmony and bondedness. And one of the ways that we can do that is to go horseback riding. But even when one kid hates horses, you don't have to give up your value, because your value is deeper and under there. And those values can be lasting values, that don't change over time. But there are multiple ways that you can flex to meet the needs of your family and still hold on to those values.
Yeah. And I also think of, not to get too deep into things right now, but I think of situations where families have what they think to be their values as their guiding light, and then something happens where a different set of values come to light that actually were their foundational values after all. So I'm just thinking a child who comes out as gay or something, and it used to be a very conservative family, but the family realizes, hey, what's more important is family and the person and that kind of thing. So it's being open to recognizing that sometimes you lay your values down and you think they're set in stone. As long as you're self-aware and, you're willing to have open conversations, and there's that mutual respect we talked about before, again, both family and the workplace, sometimes you have to come back around and realize, oh, we didn't quite have those values written down like they actually were, so let's make some changes here and remind ourselves of what really matters.
And a lot of times people think they're writing their values, but they're really... values are very emotion-based beliefs. They come out of that. And so if there is a value that we only value heterosexual people, then you're in trouble for sure. But if you say, we are a family that values the human spirit and the expressions of that human spirit, then that's a value that can carry you through no matter what,
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And sometimes people, like I had a family once that said, well, we have a value of, going on vacations together every summer. And I go, that's not really a value. That's kind of that's something, closer to the surface. Your value there is that we really value our family harmony and want to protect our time to be together, to make sure that our bondedness stays in place. It's something like that, was a little verbose, but
Sure. I know what you mean.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, values is another whole topic that we could spend a lot of
time. Of course, all of these could be their own podcast probably.
Yeah, totally.
But this has been absolutely fascinating. Just seeing the way they play off each other, even if I had one of these things in my mind, just the way it's applied to the other is really interesting. So I appreciate you sharing that research and your experience in that realm. Hopefully it's very instructional, educational, and eye-opening for our listeners as well. And I encourage them to reach out to us. You can reach Craig. He can respond to you pretty easily at Craig Ballantyne on Instagram. It's a quick way to get a hold of him. You can also comment on this episode on our website. If you have any questions or comments, I can even share them with Joanne after the fact if you have any questions for her.
Yeah, it'd be great.
I'm sure you'd be happy to follow up with them. And to everyone who's listening, if you're more interested in what Joanne does and some of her books, you can visit, is it joannesternphd.com?
Right. Yeah, that's my website.
Okay. And is it, it's Joanne, J-O-A-N-N-E?
Right.
Okay. S-T-E-R-N, PhD.com. So go ahead and check that out. See what else she's doing right now and her books. And then is there anything else that's coming up for you, events that you want to promote, speaking engagements? We'd love to let the readers and the listeners know about it.
Oh, well, I do have a couple of events coming up, but I'm not sure it's applicable here.
Okay, no, that's totally fine.
There are speaking like engagements and conferences and stuff, but I'm not sure that it's applicable to your audience. So okay. I would be happy to answer any questions that people have. And Jeff, thanks so much for your input and your comments. And you stimulated my thinking, and you added some things to my thoughts. And I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hopefully, we can collaborate on something in the future because this has been a lot of fun.
Great, for me too. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Wow, that episode was so money, so money. It was really, really fantastic. I just took so many notes from it. And I love that Joanne's advice is just so practical and applicable for every family and for every partnership, even if it's not a family partnership, and for every person that wants to build sustainable wealth. You know, her focus on value and vision is the same thing I have at my workshops, where I say that values and visions drive every decision. So if you're in the wealth building phase of your life and you'd like to learn more about how you can get coaching and accountability from me as you grow your business, then visit perfectlifeworkshop.com today and fill in the application to see if it's a good fit for you. Finally, we'd love to hear what you think about today's show and how you're going to use Joanne's advice to create healthier relationships at work and at home. So keep me posted and email me at support@earlytorise.com or send me a message on Instagram. My handle there is Real Craig Ballantyne, or at twitter.com/Craig Ballantyne. So thanks for listening to Early to Rise Radio. One last favor, just head over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating because this episode has been so valuable. Rate today's show and share with your friends. Really appreciate it, and looking forward to talking to you soon.